Hey there, sex fans. Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, January 26th, 2011, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge, with your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. That's me. So, psychologist Christopher Ryan, co-author of Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality, returns for part two of our chat for this Sex Wisdom podcast series. I can't tell you how grateful I am that he has more time to spend with us today. And just so you know, today's show is unusually long. But one would probably expect that since we cover most of human evolutionary history, don't you know? Christopher, however, makes the time fly by with his engaging and humorous style. I sure hope you didn't miss part one of this exciting conversation, which appeared here last week at this time. But not to worry if you did, because you can find it and all of my podcasts in the podcast archive on my site, drdicksexadvice.com. All you got to do is use the search function in the header, type in podcast number 257, and voila! But don't forget to use the pound sign when you do your search. Christopher invites you to learn more about Sex at Dawn by visiting their site, sexatdawn.com, of course. You can also find him on Facebook, and don't miss his Twitter feed, at Sex at Dawn, don't you know? Today's program is once again brought to you by Dr. Dick's How To Video Library. You know, even though I get tons of email from folks looking for my advice, I can only respond to a limited number of inquiries at any given time. But that doesn't mean that I don't care about everyone who writes in. I do. That's why I've set up the How To Video Library. You'll find a link to this great resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the How To Video Library banner in the sidebar. The video library is the go-to place for all of you who have sexual performance questions. You'll be able to watch all kinds of deliciously entertaining, delightfully enriching, and oh-so-informative videos right from the comfort of your own home. How sweet is that? All right, without further ado, let's get on with the show. Welcome back, Christopher, and thank you again for joining us here at DrDicksSexAdvice.com for this Sex Wisdom podcast. My mind is still reeling from, you know, the wonderful conversation we had last week, and we covered so much territory, and yet there is so much more that I want to talk to you about. So I'd like to pick up precisely where we left off. Last time we were talking much about human prehistory and how that is different than our current history. You take great pleasure in saying, forget that what you've heard about human beings being descendant from apes. We didn't descend from apes. We are apes. And I just want to say that you sure know how to make baby Jesus cry, huh?
Yeah, it's probably not the first time I've made him cry. Or the last. Yeah, well, you know, I reject, and I think any scientist rejects out of hand the notion that human beings are not animals. Mm-hmm. You know, any doctor, anyone who works with the body or the brain will certainly confirm that human beings are animals, and I don't think anyone but the most radical religious fundamentalists would argue with that point at this point.
Right.
So yeah, human beings are animals, and once you accept that, then, you know, where do you classify them? Well, they're African great apes. Mm-hmm. That's what we are. Mm-hmm. Along with chimps, bonobos, gorillas, and you know, that's pretty much it. As far as the African great apes, then you've got orangutans in Asia and gibbons, the lesser apes. Mm-hmm. So that's what we are, yeah, like it or not. And so it's very interesting in trying to understand what human beings have evolved to do and feel to look at the apes that are closest to us, which are the chimps and the bonobos.
And if I understand you correctly, we three ape groups are more like each other than we are like our cousin, the gorilla.
Yeah, the chimp, the common chimp, the bonobo, and the human being are much closer to each other than any of us is to any other primate outside of that group. In fact, Jared Diamond wrote a book called The Third Chimpanzee, talking about human beings, and where he argued that we really are, and not only he, but many primatologists have argued that we're really three subspecies of chimp. Scientifically, the smartest, the most parsimonious way to categorize us would be to say there are chimps, and there are three types of chimps, the human, the bonobo, and what we call the common chimp.
I love it.
Yeah. And to give you a sense, I mean, humans are closer to chimps and bonobos than the Indian elephant is to the African elephant.
Is that right?
Yeah, in terms of genetics. Huh. You know, we're closer to them than a dog is to a fox. You know, we're extremely closely related. And one point that your listeners might take away from this is that we are equidistant from chimps and bonobos. Because what happened was that our last common ancestor was about 5 million years ago. At that point, the line split into two. Mm-hmm. One of those lines led to us. Mm-hmm. The other line split a million years ago, and that led to chimps and bonobos.
Interesting.
So it's impossible to say we're closer to chimps or bonobos. We are equidistant from the two of them, which becomes relevant when you consider how different those two species are, and becomes sort of enraging when you realize just how much the bonobo is ignored in the popular press and even in the scientific press, where people are talking about the human origins of violence, right, and the human origins of male domination and so on. They always refer back to the chimp because the chimp is violent and male dominated and so on and so forth. But they leave the bonobo out. And that's maybe convenient, but it's scientifically inexcusable. Because the bonobo is female dominated, and bonobo society is one of peace and relaxation and low stress, and much more like what we're talking about with pre-agricultural ancestors.
So in terms of sexuality, we humans behave more like bonobos than chimps.
Well, that's the question. You know, you could argue both sides of that. On the chimp side, you could say, well, you know, chimps kill their babies sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's infanticide, there's war, there's rape, there's murder, and all those things are obviously present in human society. Mm-hmm. So some could make an argument that says, well, humans are more like chimps. But on the other side, you say, well, you've got, with bonobos, you've got sexuality that is always available. In other words, female bonobos are willing to have sex when they're already pregnant, when they're not ovulating, when they're postmenopausal. They have a lot of homosexual interactions. And again, all these things are found in human societies. So you can argue both sides of the point, but what is most important to me is that both sides are represented in these arguments.
Right.
What generally happens is that the chimps are represented and the bonobos are left unmentioned.
When you were here in Seattle, you showed us a video clip of friendly bonobo behavior. I think you called it the bonobo handshake.
Well, the video was supplied to me by Vanessa Woods, who wrote a book called Bonobo Handshake. And the phrase comes about because what she argues in the book is that for bonobos, having sex is basically like a handshake.
Right.
It's a very casual, friendly greeting, you know, goodbye. It's not a big deal, and it generally doesn't even lead to ejaculation. So it's not really about reproduction. It's about establishing social contact. It's it's like grooming.
Right,
it's a handshake.
Right.
It's a pat on the back. It's whatever. So yeah, and that's another element in which human sexuality is much closer to bonobo sexuality, I would argue, than it is to chimp sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's face it, human beings use sex for many, many different things, and reproduction is near the bottom of the list.
Right. And especially now that we can eliminate the idea of reproduction from sexual congress, it has opened the door considerably since the 1960s and the advent of the pill.
Yeah, yeah, and even that is interesting to look at in terms of the changes that have come about since agriculture, because if you look at fertility in hunter-gatherer societies, some interesting things come up that you might not expect. For example, women in hunter-gatherer societies generally start ovulating in their late teens. So 18, 19, mm-hmm. they start off, but they're sexually active quite a bit before that.
Right.
So there's, you know, 5-6 years in which they're sexually active, but they're not going to get pregnant.
Interesting.
So then when they start getting pregnant, when they start ovulating and they get pregnant pretty regularly, they breastfeed their children 3 to 5 years on average. And during the time that a woman's breastfeeding, she generally won't get pregnant either, because the lactation stops the ovulation process.
Right.
So again, those are 3 to 5 years in which she's still having sex but not getting pregnant mm-hmm. again. So the fertility in hunter-gatherer societies is actually quite a bit lower than it is in post-agricultural societies, where they're using cow milk for the,
exactly.
the babies and go back to ovulating quite quickly after birth.
Right. Is there any evidence for monogamy or sexual exclusivity among any of our closest living ape relatives?
The only ape that is monogamous is the gibbon, which lives in Southeast Asia, in the treetops, is non-gregarious, meaning they don't form social groups larger than the immediate nuclear family. Very low libido. They have sex only when the female's ovulating, which is quite infrequent. And the males and the females are very difficult to tell apart. They're the same size, same coloration in most of the subspecies. So that's the only ape that's monogamous. If you look at primates in general, and there are differing estimations of how many distinct species of primate there are, but generally around 250 is the accepted range, there are precisely 0 group-living, multi-male, monogamous primates, except human beings, if you want to believe the Catholic Church.
And I do, God knows.
Yes. So the what I'm getting at is that this is yet another point that supports the notion that it's vanishingly unlikely that our ancestors evolved in monogamous nuclear families within a larger social group. It just doesn't happen mm-hmm. among primates. So gorillas are the next closest primate to us after chimps and bonobos. They're not monogamous, but they are polygynous. So it's a one male, multiple female situation.
So the standard narrative that we talked about last week suggests that humans suddenly made this great leap from multiple sex partners, casual sexual encounters, to sexual exclusivity and monogamy, even though all the evidence regarding human sexuality from fantasy to behavior belies this notion. So again, the cultural prejudice must be operative.
Well, the standard notion doesn't really posit that we made a leap. In fact, the standard narrative holds that we've always been monogamous. All the way back to about 4 million years ago. You know, in fact, Owen Lovejoy, who's one of the best known anthropologists in the world, argues quite often and tiringly that that the reason human beings started walking upright was so that the males could bring back the food that they hunted to their wives. And so, you know, even our bipedalism was in service of monogamy. And he, that guy can argue anything in support of monogamy. It's amazing. You know, that's, to me, that's kind of ridiculous. But yeah, the standard narrative holds that monogamy has been part of the human sexual repertoire, or central to human sexual behavior, for millions of years. So about four million years ago, our ancestors, the Australopithecus, was presumed to be a harem-based, single male, multiple female mater, because the male skeletons appear to indicate that the males were much bigger than the females, which is an indication of a harem-based mating system.
Interesting. And yet we still have, you know, the hangover of that, you know, in many cultures. I mean, there's polygamous cultures throughout, you know, human experience. You know, one male, the harem of females. And some of that is actually religiously, you know, approbated.
Yes, I would argue that it's not a hangover or a lingering effect of Australopithecus, because you don't find harems in hunter-gatherer people.
Interesting.
So what we argue in Sex at Dawn is that these harems are a logical result of societies in which all power is concentrated in the hands of a few men. So it makes perfect sense that these men are going to dominate mating opportunities, just like they dominate every other form of wealth that they can accumulate.
So it's basically economics and not sex that we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. It's about accumulating wealth. So they accumulate the land, they accumulate the animals, they accumulate the women, they accumulate the water. You know, they dominate as much as they can possibly dominate.
Right. You know, another thing that I never considered until I read your book was the distinction that you make between social monogamy and sexual monogamy. You and Casilda go out of your way to make this point, and I think it's so extraordinarily important to understanding all that we see around us. Would you be so kind as to address that again here?
Sure. The difference is just that social monogamy is where a male and a female make a pact to cooperate in raising young. We see this with birds very often, where, you know, it really takes two birds to take care of the chicks, because one has to, you know, be on the nest while the other is out gathering food. So you need that sort of teamwork. It was assumed until relatively recently that these nesting couples were sexually monogamous, but right, once it became possible to test the DNA in the feathers of the chicks and the feathers of the male, it became apparent that in almost all bird species that were presumed to be monogamous, there's a great deal of cuckoldry going on. So, yeah. A lot of the males who are taking care of the chicks are not biologically the father of those chicks. So that's, you know, those are cases of social monogamy, but obviously not sexual monogamy. And you see this as well in human societies. Obviously, there are varying estimations of, you know, the extent to which social fathers are not biological fathers, but they range from 10 to 20% in most cases. These tests have been done by hospitals like one where I was working here in Spain that are testing for, they test the genetics of the parents because they're looking for markers of rare kidney diseases and so on. And they don't tell the parents, they don't tell the fathers when they find out that the father is not biologically the father, but they find these results. But you also see this in more liberal hunter-gatherer societies where, although there may be a male and a female who are considered to be a couple, there's no assumption that the children that woman has will all be fathered by that male. And in fact, you have many societies in the Amazon basin particularly that believe that a child can be fathered by more than one male and should be, because the child will end up being healthier and happier if he or she has more than one father.
The idea is to get the attributes of, you know, the hunter, the attributes of the shaman, the attributes of the artist, you know, to commingle to make the ideal baby, yes?
Exactly, because their understanding of conception is that a baby is literally made of accumulated semen.
Interesting.
So the mother who wants to combine the essence of all these different men in her baby will make sure she has sex with the best hunter and the smartest guy and the funniest guy and so on, so that each man will make a contribution, quite literally, to her baby. And then when the child's born, these different men typically recognize their paternity of the child and take a special interest in the child throughout its life.
Interesting. So one of my favorite sections in your book, Pervert That I Am, is your discussion of the evolution of male genitalia among us apes. Cock shape and size, as well as the dimensions of our balls, has something to tell us about our sexual proclivities, right?
A lot, yeah. Yeah, the genitalia of any animal tells you about the sexual behavior of the ancestors, because genitalia evolve very quickly and are very responsive to evolutionary pressure. So what our genitalia, the male genitalia, tell us is quite strongly that our ancestors' sex lives were promiscuous, meaning that any female typically in one ovulatory cycle had sex with several males. So how do we know this? Well, first of all, if you look at gorillas that we mentioned earlier, where you have one male and several females in the social group, you find that the males grow physically much larger than the females. And the reason for this is that the competition between males takes place on the level of the individual. So the biggest, strongest, fiercest male generally wins, expels the other males from the group, and then he is the only male who has sex with the females. So his genes for size and strength get passed on to his male progeny. Now, what happens with animals like chimps and bonobos and humans, where the competition is not taking place so much on the individual level, but on the genital level, on the level of the sperm cell, because several males are having sex with a female in every ovulatory cycle, is that you've got adaptive pressure on sperm production, the motility of the sperm, on the delivery system of the sperm, which is the penis. And so you end up with much larger testicles, larger penis, different shape penis, because you've got different sorts of competition happening, which we can get into later, But an external testicles in a scrotum, which serves to keep the temperature in the testicles lower than body temperature, which preserves reserve sperm cells so that the males can have several ejaculations one after another without waiting to produce more sperm cells. You've got a, as we say in the book, it's like having a spare fridge in the garage just for beer. So you're ready for a party to break out at any moment. You don't just have the six pack in the kitchen. You've also got a few cases out in the garage, so you're ready to go at any time.
So let's hear it for a sperm competition.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the gorillas, you end up with male gorillas twice the size of females, but a gorilla's penis is the size of your pinky finger, and the gorilla's testicles are the size of kidney beans. And they're located inside his abdomen. He doesn't have external scrotum. Ah. So obviously the human, if you look at the human penis, the human testicles, and the fact that humans are human males are about 15 to 20% larger and heavier than females, obviously we're in the group with the chimps and the bonobos.
I'll say, because I often look at penises and testicles. I don't know why. It's a genetic thing, I think.
Just a lot of them hanging around.
Huh? Exactly. You know, when I started reading your book, and this picks up on something you just said a moment ago, one thing that jumped out at me from the get-go was your use of the word promiscuous. This raised an immediate red flag for me, because that word almost always has a pejorative connotation, at least in the popular parlance. I think it was Kinsey who said that promiscuous is a term that we use to describe those who are getting more than we are. But your use of the word is meant to convey something completely different. It is not a judgment word. It's, you use it from a scientific perspective, right?
Yeah, we use the word, we take it back to its origins, which I don't remember if it was Greek or Latin, but it simply means to mix. Mm-hmm. So promiscuous in our use simply means that there was more than one male having sex with a female in a typical monthly cycle.
Interesting.
So, and that gave rise to the various adaptive pressures on the genitalia and so on that we discussed.
Right.
So it certainly isn't a value judgment, especially given the fact that, you know, even if we're right about our ancestors having had 5, 6, 7 ongoing sexual relationships at any given point in their lives, that doesn't mean that any of those relationships were casual or unfeeling.
Exactly.
Sort of not intimate in any sense, because the people that they were having sex with were people that they lived with, that they had lived with most or all of their lives in most cases, and people they spent all their time with. It's like growing up in a village of 150 people. Okay, maybe you have sex with some of those, several of those people, but it certainly isn't unfeeling or unintimate.
Right, right. It's not a zipless fuck or, you know, a casual hookup.
Exactly. They, you know, you or I can go out tonight and meet someone and have sex with them an hour later. That wasn't possible in the environment of our ancestors.
Mm-hmm. But long-term, you know, sexual encounters with, you know, people who you were familiar with was something that happened all the time. I mean, deep,
the
abiding relationships.
Yeah, the evidence suggests that that was the standard human life.
Interesting. Gosh, I long for the old days, I got to tell you. You know, in the final chapter of Sex at Dawn, you write, "Having written a whole book about sex, we'd like to confusingly suggest that most of us take sex way too seriously. When it's just sex, that's all it is. In such cases, it's not love or sin or pathology or a good reason to destroy an otherwise happy family. This is a marvelous conclusion from my point of view, and I suppose in this instance, sex is like food. Sometimes it is sacrament, but mostly it's just sustenance. Would you agree?
Yeah. I think the parallels between sex and food are many. And and that's another good one. It's, you know, there's no there's no insult inherent in having a sandwich because you're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't mean that you know, the special dinner you had last week is any less special.
So true.
You know, I also look at it in terms of music. You know, there's sacred music. There's you know, maybe the late Beethoven quartets are what you want to be played at your funeral, but you're not insulting Beethoven by, you know, dancing to the Rolling Stones.
Exactly.
It's completely different, and one has really nothing to do with the other. So I don't really understand how it is that we have bought this line of bullshit that we've been fed about sex, where sex is the one thing in our lives that we can't, somehow we're incapable of having both a deep relationship with it at some times and a more casual relationship with it at other times. It just doesn't make sense.
And if you consume one thing, it doesn't say much more about you than you like the one thing. I mean, I'm constantly being barraged by people who say, you know, I like having my dick sucked, and or I like sucking a dick. Does that make me gay? And I'm thinking, well, you know, do you like Chinese food? And if you go to a Chinese restaurant and order Chinese food and enjoy it, does that make you Chinese? I don't think so. Unless you were Chinese before you went to the restaurant. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I mean, even Chinese, if you're, you know, your parents were Chinese, but you were adopted and raised in the States.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
I mean, are you Chinese? Who knows?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole question of homosexuality is that's another show. That's,
yes.
You know, because one of the things I found when I was researching the book, and I don't think we don't really go into this much in the book, but the question of what is a homosexual or what constitutes homosexuality becomes very confusing when you look at it across different cultural contexts. For example, in Papua New Guinea, there are a few tribes that believe that the essence of masculinity is semen. It's the, you know, the most manly substance there is.
Mm-hmm.
So the young men who are sort of like, you know, the equivalent of the captain of the football team, you know, the super macho, you know, physically more developed than his peers, and, you know, he's going to be a leader and a great warrior and all that. In order to sort of fortify his masculinity, he will give as many blowjobs as possible so that he can ingest this essence of masculinity. Now, we might say, well, that's homosexual behavior. He's running around sucking dicks. But to them, he's just becoming a man.
Exactly.
He's becoming a really manly man.
Yes.
And it has nothing to do with sexual identity. You know, the same thing happens in the Maasai people in Africa. There's a period of their lives where the older boys and the younger boys have sex, and it's just considered completely normal. And then they go on and, you know, marry women and have kids and do the rest of it.
Right.
So it's very difficult to tease out sexual behavior and sexual identity and all these sorts of things that in the West we sort of assume we know what we're talking about, but it sort of melts. It's like ice in your hands. It starts melting if you handle it too much, I think.
Right. And on top of it, you know, our classifications and our way of looking at things are all conditioned by, you know, our personal experience and, you know, what we have been through and what our cultural dictates are, and I suspect those cannot, you know, be universal and, you know, carried to apply to other cultures.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's like there's interesting research showing that the language that we grow up speaking really determines the concepts we're capable of understanding.
Right.
You know, it's so what you're saying is true. It's we apply the tools we've been given to understand and to conceptualize our experience. So the fact that someone else has a completely different tool set means that they're going to conceptualize their experience in a way we can't really understand. And as an example, there's a word, one of my favorite Spanish words is morbo, which really has no translation to English. It's from the same root as morbid and morbidity.
Right.
But in English, morbid means preoccupied with death and, you know, sort of dark, evil kind of thing. But morbo in Spanish refers to a quality of someone who is attractive without being pretty in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say Mick Jagger or Jack Nicholson.
Mm-hmm.
They have morbo. There's something about them that women and presumably men find attractive, but they're not pretty to look at.
Right. Interesting.
You know, I don't,
fascinating.
I can't think of a word like that in English, and that mm-hmm. says something about two different societies.
Right. So what does the future hold for you and your work? Is there another book tour in the offing? Do you foresee a sequel to Sex at Dawn, perhaps Son of Sex at Dawn, or Sex in the Morning or something?
Nothing quite that obvious, I don't think, no. I'm working on another book now, which I guess in some ways could be seen as a sequel, but it's not primarily about sex. It's about expanding on some of these differences between modern life and hunter-gatherer life.
Interesting.
And looking at, many different aspects of modern life and why, sort of trying to understand why modern life is so unfulfilling despite the fact that it's materially so luxurious.
Right.
That's,
you know,
why
I want to read, because I that's completely perplexing to me.
So that's the book I'm looking at. It's going to be another big idea book. And then maybe after that, I'll go back and do something about sex again. We'll
Yay.
See.
Well, with that, we must conclude. And I'm eternally grateful for all of this time. It's been such a joy meeting you like this and chatting with you. It's so wonderful. But before we conclude, will you give us your website address again and walk us around?
Sure. The website is sexatdawn.com. And you can find excerpts from the book there, blurbs, reviews, interviews. You know, you can waste lots of time looking around on the website.
And we can buy your book through your site too, yes?
Yeah, there's a link on the website. You can buy the book. And also the Facebook and Twitter feeds are there on the front page. And we'll see if things go well. Maybe I'll do a media tour, go around and promote the paperback, which comes out this summer.
Outstanding.
So,
well, we look forward to seeing you again in Seattle, because it was a joy meeting you there too.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun in Seattle. I had no idea it was such a hotbed of alternative.
Oh, I know. I know. Well, until then, Christopher, be well. Thank you again for your time. My best to your lovely wife. And we will be seeing you in cyberspace.
Okay. Thank you very much, Richard.
Bye now. What a terrific show. Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Tune in next time for more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. Listen up, buckaroos.
Thanks to this amazing technology, you'll be able to watch your choice of smut from the comfort of your own home. With just a little prompting from you, they're going to come gushing out of your computer like, well, nobody's business. Check it out. You'll find a link to this fabulous resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the banner that reads, How to Video Library. There is no membership fee. This is a pay-per-minute kind of deal. So that your pay-per-view minutes allow you to watch whatever content you want for whatever length of time you choose. Pretty gall-darn sweet, huh? One more thing before we conclude. I want to make sure that you know about my product review site, drdicksextoyreviews.com. That's right, sex fans. Now you can see what's hot and what's not in the world of adult products. I and the Dr. Dick review crew review all kinds of goodies for adults. Sex toys for sure, but also condoms, herbal products, lubes, and fetish wear and gear, as well as educational enrichment videos. Don't miss a single one. Be sure to check them out. The site is drdicksextoyreviews.com. Until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.